Today is We're Not Our Hearts Burning. We're going to be talking about time and celebration and the holy in our life experience. And what I've tried to do with these several sessions on God of My Days and Nights and Experiential Look at Spirituality is to try and help us look at our own unique life experience and how God has been at work in our lives in ways that we know, but it's good to help ourselves and remind ourselves of and just take some time with. It would be helpful if I knew how many people have not been to either one of the sessions so far. Just one person. Okay. So far what we've taken a look at has been attitudes and ideas about ourselves and self-esteem, and a little bit about how spirituality can be differentiated from faith and theology and so on.
Excuse me, I was to one of your classes. Is that related to this one?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay,
yeah.
I missed one.
Oh, okay, the first one. Yeah. Uh-huh. And then last time we talked about community and solitude and how both elements are really part of the lived experience of our spirituality. What I'd like to do today is structure our time a bit around this story, which is probably, if not my favorite scripture passage, one of my favorites of the disciples in Emmaus at the end of Luke's Gospel. And
of the what?
The disciples in Emmaus after the resurrection. And I think what I'll do, if that's okay with you, is read it to you at this point and just ask you to listen. What I'd ask you to listen for is how is their experience perhaps similar to mine, to yours in some ways, and we'll explore that further as we go. So this begins with verse 13. Two of them that same day, and we know what same day that was, right? The day that they discovered Jesus had been raised, were making their way to a village named Emmaus, 7 miles distant from Jerusalem, discussing as they went all that had happened. In the course of their lively exchange, Jesus approached and began walking along with them. However, they were restrained from recognizing him. He said to them, "What are you discussing as you go your way?" They halted in distress, and one of them, Cleopas by name, asked him, "Are you the only resident of Jerusalem who does not know the things that went on there these past few days?" He said to them, "What things?" They said, "All those that had to do with Jesus of Nazareth, a prophet powerful in word and deed in the eyes of God and all the people, how our chief priests and leaders delivered him up to be condemned to death and crucified him. We were hoping that he was the one who would set Israel free. Besides all of this, today, the third day since these things happened, some women of our group have just brought us some astounding news. They were at the tomb before dawn and failed to find his body, but returned with the tale that they had seen a vision of angels who declared he was alive. Some of our number went to the tomb and found it to be just as the women said, but him they did not see. Then he said to them, 'What little sense you have, how slow you are to believe all that the prophets have announced. Did not the Messiah have to undergo all this so as to enter into his glory?' Beginning then with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted for them every passage of scripture which referred to him." Must have been an amazing theology lesson, Bible study. By then they were near the village to which they were going, and he acted as if he were going farther. But they pressed him, "Stay with us. It is nearly evening. The day is practically over." So they went in to stay with. He went in to stay with them. When he had seated himself with them to eat, he took bread, pronounced the blessing, then broke the bread and began to distribute it to them. With that, their eyes were opened and they recognized him, whereupon he vanished from their sight. They said to one another, "Were not our hearts burning inside us as he talked to us on the road and explained the scriptures to us?" They got up immediately and returned to Jerusalem, where they found the 11 and the rest of the company assembled. They were greeted with, "The Lord has been raised, it is true. He has appeared to Simon." Then they recounted what had happened on the road and how they had come to know him in the breaking of the bread. Well, for me, that passage is one that I've read and reread and used in a variety of retreat settings and all kinds of things. But I'd like to use it today in a different sort of way than I think I've ever used it before. What I'm going to ask each of us to do, and you have two choices of how to do it, that those of you who've been in one of my sessions before know that I put you to work pretty fast, is either to do, and you may have done this before, a personal timeline. Okay, say if you're my age, you're 45, and look at your life from 0 to 45 and kind of chart for yourself some of the main things that have happened in that time, or however old you are. Or another way you can do it, which will kind of accomplish the same thing, is to look at five key turning points in your life. Now, what does this have to do with what I just read? If you think about what we just heard, the disciples, whoever these two were, had been figuring and hoping that their lives were going in one direction, and all of a sudden it had taken a sharp turn in an unexpected direction for them. And they were trying to understand what that was about. And Jesus invites them to do that in light of the tradition that they are already a part of, but continues to be lived out in new ways in their own experience. And I don't want to say a whole lot more than that right now until I've asked you to kind of reflect on this in terms of your own life, but then we'll hopefully explore that a bit more from there.
Excuse me, when you talk, could you speak this way instead of to the point?
Sure, I'm sorry, yeah. So what I'd like us to do now is to go ahead and do either the timeline of our own personal life or the five key turning points. Five key experiences that, if I had made another choice at that point in my life, and certainly there are more than five, my life might have been considerably different than it is. So if you could take some time with that, those of you who brought paper and pencil, I would suggest that you write it down, and I've got some more paper here if you'd like. Okay? Let's do that for a few minutes now, and then we'll kind of continue our conversation. Yes, I do. Again, grab some before I get in here. Who else would like paper and pencil?
Need a pencil if you have it.
Anybody else need something to write with their piece of paper?
Okay, usually there's a microphone here. Let's see.
Here's a...
Oh, it's down there. What I've invited people to do is to think about five key turning points in their life so far, or to chart a kind of a timeline for what's happened. And just to mention, if you've not done this exercise before, there's a whole lot more that could be done in terms of this personal timeline thing. To talk about what's been the hardest time, what's been the high point, you know, and to do an up and down line, and to talk about missed opportunities, all kinds of things in there, but we're not going to go into it in that great a depth today.
What chapter was that that you read the?
It's chapter 24 of Luke 13 through 35.
You have to write something down.
Pardon?
She said, what'll I do? I said, you have to write something down.
Do people need more time?
To do doer, not a writer downer.
Since I think most people are close to finished with those five situations, would you please turn to the person next to you and share about one of those turning points? Just take a couple minutes at that. So don't go into too great a detail, but just talk about how important that point in your life was, please, with someone else near you. Once you start talking about that stuff, and I noticed that the other 2 days, that once I start talking about my experience, or you do, it goes and goes, doesn't it? Did you hear anything, not in terms of specifics, but anything that seemed real common between the two experiences that you shared that you'd like to share with the whole group? Were they pretty different life experiences, or were they much common?
Elements. People grow up at different ages.
Uh-huh.
I think that's what we found out.
Yeah. That's because I'm this age doesn't mean
that. Like you become aware.
Yeah.
Or they grow at stages.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Not at once.
This came up yesterday, and I commented at the time that it was something I hadn't expected as much then as to deal with today. How much, in terms of either the point that you shared or what you heard from your partner or other turning points in your lives, had to do with dying and new life, with the process of death and resurrection, which came into our passage? Yes. Mm-hmm. Go ahead in the background.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yes.
Uh-huh. The one that you shared, or many of them?
Oh, no, I didn't.
Uh-huh. It was there.
Uh-huh. Oh, absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I don't think anybody's alive.
Okay. Was it an actual death of someone close to you, or how was it?
Oh, yes. I can explain. Well, my parents both died of Alzheimer's, but part of it was dealing with their adult foster providers. Mm-hmm. One couple that had fled from Romania that was their provider. And working with them. And then the other providers, with people that you might consider developmentally disabled, but functioning in that environment and the love that they gave. You know, so here, in the midst of, and this was all happening at the same time, they were both happening at the same time, but you learn to kind of look beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
And especially the couple from Romania and how they were readjusting to living.
Mm-hmm.
Or from Oregon, and
mm-hmm.
living in the United States,
mm-hmm.
and how they had to flee. That was during the communist regime. I can't think of the fellow's name.
Yeah.
Ceausescu. Anyway, during his regime, that they had to flee, that they had to flee. And their whole escape. And here were these people giving a lot of attention to my mother, who quite frankly was really obnoxious. And I was surprised that they would be so kind,
mm-hmm.
because she was nearly driving us fast, you know, just by, you know, the disease was was not making her particularly jump. We would go to visit with them, you know, that was really more appreciative for us, you know, than to go to the church. People get a little, you know, loud and verbal. But in any event, I don't think, and other people that have gone through death and dying experiences, I don't think there's any.
Let's push that business of death and resurrection, dying, and new life a little further. Are there some experiences that you might identify as far as dying and new life that aren't a literal death of someone close to you?
Yeah, I think all of my five turning points had to do with that. I was headed in a direction that I thought was the right direction or what I had chosen, and it turns out that that God had a different idea, and sometimes that was evident in the immediate present that's what's happening, and sometimes I couldn't tell that until I looked back afterwards. But in all cases, it was a dying to what had been,
Or what you thought was going to be.
Right. Yeah. And and oftentimes, usually, what I thought I wanted, I did want, but it turns out it worked out for the best.
Thanks.
I feel Evelyn has something that she wants to say.
Do you?
Do
you, though?
Evelyn has something she wants to say. She's really on a high these days. I was telling her that when I was born, I had scoliosis and did the usual exercises and everything. And, you know, and I, for years, the way they made you do things, but they didn't put us in braces at the do today, I understand. But anyway, and I completely forgot about scoliosis. You know, I was fine. Anyway, about 20 years ago, about 24 years ago, I guess it was, we were in a serious car accident where it injured my spine. And so, you know, I ended up in the hospital and braces and traction. And for a couple of years, this is my life, you know, with the braces and traction and so forth. And as each time, you know, after a bit, it would get real bad, and then I would have to go into the hospital like in traction for 3 weeks at a time. And the doctor kept, well, after many, many times, he finally said to me, you know, you have to have your back fused. And so I didn't like that because I knew that it could be successful or it could not be. And so anyway, the last time that I went in, I was in for 3 weeks in traction, and he came in and he says, you know, I brought your case before and showed your x-rays and everything to a bunch of physicians around the table, and everyone said fusion, fusion, fusion. He said, that's the only answer, and I'll be back tomorrow morning. He said at 8:30, I want you to make a decision. He said, I really want you to think about it. Well, you know, I knew that our church and prayer community and everybody was praying for me, but then I was telling her that morning, around 7 o'clock in the morning, I get a call from a very dear friend of ours, and he said, I just want you to know that the truck drivers across the country are praying for you. You know, they have this CB and this prayer line. And I just lay there and I thought, you know, there's a church, family, friends, truck drivers, everybody's praying for me. And I said, you know, Lord, if I was you, I'd listen to these good people. My doctor came in. And I said, no, I'm not going to have fusion. I'm going to be healed, you know. Well, that's 20 years ago. Now, I have scoliosis. I mean, you know, I got a very pretty back. But, I mean, it's there. It's still there and everything. And I do get back aches, but I haven't been, knock wood, in traction or anything in 20 years. Wow. So that was just the way. And you know, the Lord really... pretty powerful.
Listen to you, too.
Not to.
She must be obeying.
That's a great one.
Is there anyone for whom the dying and new life is not a part of at least some of those turning points in your life? you know, what's increasingly occurred to me, and maybe it has to do with as I have more experience in life and so on, that I think there are many ways in which dying a new life is a part of our lives. And yeah, it takes pretty dramatic forms at times, but I think it's there in a pretty daily sort of way that suggests that we might want to look at. Certainly, the disciples at Emmaus had some powerful experience that they were trying to sort out, and telling the story of that experience helped them really be ready, at least in their hearts, to hear the story that Jesus told them, and then later for it to fully connect in the process of the breaking of the bread with the Eucharist. And we'll talk about that part of the passage in a moment. But it seems to me, increasingly, as I look at my life and others' experience around me, that there are so many little deaths and resurrections in our lives every day. From the process of saying goodbye, which we do a lot of at Holden, and we did before we left our home, and we'll do almost every day. We have one family that are friends of ours. When the kids or whoever's going out the door for the day asks for a blessing, because, you know, it sounds morbid, but who knows whether everybody will return safe at the end of the day. To the process of sleeping, to letting go of the day that has been, and really resting in God's care for the night. To the process of learning, where I really died to what I thought I knew about what the world was like, and really understanding it in a new way. And I think we do a lot of that here at Holden. I find that really exciting. To even the process of cleaning. I mean, that's getting very, you know, specific, but most of the time I find when I clean something, I have to make a bigger mess before it ends up clean. There's a way in which, you know, the way things were is dying to something new. Does that fit your experience, that there are a lot of little deaths and resurrections? And anybody want to add to that in terms of ways that you see that at work? On a pretty daily basis?
Well, one of our pivotal experience was having two handicapped kids, and I think that real dramatically is a death and a resurrection, because it's the death of the dream of the child that you thought you were going to have. But I think what is interesting in having worked with parents of kids with special needs is that what you realize is that it's really just a intensification of what every parent goes through. Because any time you have a child, and I think the earlier it happens, the more healthy it is, you go through the death of somehow the dream of that perfect child. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think the parent who doesn't do that really victimizes the child. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That part of even that birth is to give up and put to death the dream of this kind of mythical, wonderful child who is going to be what you want them to be. And if you don't give that up, it really is damaging. Mm-hmm. And so even that birth is very much a death.
And from that moment, they start leaving us. And
yes, right.
Leaving out, you know, any kinds of ideas we have of who and what they're to be, really. Yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking, along with that, too, is the death of the myth of the perfect parent. It's just really hard to notice.
Or kids. Perfect spouse.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
God's will in our lives.
Uh-huh.
You
know,
what he's showing us, why, what happened in our lives. Yeah. And living and going ahead as you grow older, you know, and looking ahead, not backwards.
Uh-huh.
And
uh-huh.
Thanking him for whatever he's done in your life.
Yeah.
I'm thankful.
Mm-hmm.
We're coming, like many people hit it through in their mid-30s. They come to like a total spot where they can't go on further without dragging every value, anything in their life, and going over it and getting rid of the garbage and updating the tape, you know, and getting and growing on. It's really almost maybe a total new life after that point, because you've had to let go of a lot of other things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I keep hearing, you know, the echo of, and we thought he was going to, you know, and we had it all figured out, you know, and now we don't know what to do with what's happened instead. And it seems to me we find ourselves in that place a lot of times in our lives. You know, now what? It isn't what I thought it was going to be. And, you know, and yes, I've given up my life to you, Lord, but I have to do it again and again and again, and I thought I had this all settled with you, and you still want more? You know, it's not an easy thing. Good. Great. Well, so what happens after that? When they've told their story, and they've gotten, as I say, the best Bible study or theology lesson in return, out of, and, you know, this is one of those places where it seems to me Jesus has this great tongue-in-cheek sense of humor, and, you know, well, I think I'm going to keep walking by. It's like, you know, walking on the water, and just kind of do-do-do-do-do, and they say, oh, no, come and stay with us, you know, and he waits for their invitation. And out of that invitation, the process of celebrating what they've been telling in story is such a rich experience. And, you know, it's just bread and wine, and yeah, it's so much more. And what they're left doing, which is one of my favorite parts of the passage, is looking at one another and saying, gosh, you know, weren't our hearts burning? What I'd like to do for part of the rest of the time here is to suggest that what we're called to do in our lives, in looking at our life story and at the specific things before us, is by a Jesus who was so much a part of the everyday things in our lives, to take a look at the holy in the ordinary. We know that that Jesus is God made flesh, God incarnate, but it seems to me that it's pretty easy for us at times, I know it is for me, to really forget about the very daily ways in which God is at work in our lives. It seems to me, you know, as what I was saying about the death and resurrection, the death and new life as it's part of every day, it seems to me that we need to name, to look again. I talked about yesterday, remember, and I'd like to suggest that what we really need to do is respect, to really look again at what's right before our very eyes, and that in doing so, we're very much doing what Jesus asks us to do in this passage and in other places. What are the holy times, the holy places, the holy things in my life? They're not just over there at church. Now, I mentioned at least one time before this, I come out of a Catholic tradition, a very strong sacramental tradition. It's taken me a long time in my life to realize that unlike the way I was raised as a young child, it isn't the things with a holy with a capital H that are over here in church that are the holy things. This may not relate to many of your experiences, but as a small child, it was a big deal that I had holy water fountain. Have you ever seen one? In my bedroom. And it was a glow-in-the-dark holy water fountain. Well, you know, that was a little bit of church brought home. And my spirituality has changed a whole lot in the meantime. And so now I want to ask myself, and I ask you to reflect on this right now. In my home, in your home, what is the holiest place? Most people say, holy, my house, wait a minute. What's the holiest place in your home?
I made it a place where I meditate.
Kind of a prayer corner. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's a very holy place for you.
That's the one where I feel a little peace.
Ours is our dining room. Mm-hmm. That's where our family gets together and spends time.
Mm-hmm.
I think the whole thing, our house isn't very big. I should walk around and talk to Jesus. And
there's no particular place that seems holier than any other. Anybody else?
just on the, when at home, always the kitchen table was where the gathering place and
Yeah, I'd have to say in our house that's probably true. And I've asked this question of a lot of different groups, and most people would say that. You know, some folks will say, well, our bed as a couple is a very holy place. And I think that is a very holy place for that marriage relationship. But for the family as a whole, I think one of the most holy places is the table around which we regularly gather. There's a lot of reasons, it seems to me, for that. When we do that, we, you know, Jesus says, when two or more are gathered in my name, there I am in the midst of them. And there aren't all that many times anymore when we all gather around. And the latest statistics that I've seen are that 50% of the time for an evening meal, the television is on in American homes. So then are we really together? I mean, you could really argue with that
TV
one out.
TV is the holy place in many houses.
Yeah, yeah. Scary, isn't it? But anyway, I think it's important for us to really say these are the holy places, and why. The doorway to our home is a holy place. There's a lot of important hospitality and entering in that happens in that process of coming in the door. The day has a lot of holy times to it, whether it's the process of waking up in the morning and whatever your morning ritual is and really welcoming the day and thanking God for the gift of this day, or the process of ending the day. As I said earlier, we've done a process for a number of years, and maybe you have this tradition too, of giving a nightly blessing to our kids. Well, you know, it's getting borderline not cool to ask mom and dad for a blessing, but these teenage boys still tend to do that most of the time. Can I have a blessing, please? And we know friends who started this when their kids were younger than ours, and one son went off to the Marines and came back and said, can I have your blessing, Dad? I've missed that while I was gone. You know, so these kinds of ways in which we remember, again, listen to the words, remember and respect what is right before our eyes, I think are very, very important ones. The seasons are a really important way for us to look at the holy and the ordinary, what's right before our eyes. You know, whether it's the four natural seasons or the seasons of the church year, you know, there's a lot of family traditions usually around Christmas and Advent, but there are a lot of ways that we can really name what are the holy things in our lives. I know for me, though I'm not much of a green thumb, planting a garden every year is a very holy experience for me. I'm always amazed that this little itty-bitty seed is going to amount to much, and sometimes it doesn't in my garden, but at least it amounts to more than it was in the seed packet. And so I think there's a lot of ways in which we need to look at how those things take place in our lives. Does that bring up any other ideas for you?
Well, what I think I hear you saying is, aren't you sort of advocating a simple lifestyle? Which
well,
it may not say, I am this person because I have these things,
uh-huh.
but I have this time to enjoy these things. And I was even reflecting on what your comment of daily life, just doing washing
mm-hmm.
and hanging the clothes outside, which I also do at home and I was able to do today,
mm-hmm.
is really kind of a holy experience because it's very quiet, it's a routine kind of assuring kind of thing that mm-hmm. brings back memories of my own mother and, you know, a time of, mm-hmm. you know, nurturing.
Yeah.
But advocating a simpler way of life that says, yeah, the TV goes off and we don't have six TVs in our house, so, you know.
Well, it's very interesting you bring up that point because I hadn't quite made that jump yet, but I am more and more convinced, and I'd be really interested to hear what people think of this. It seems to me, in my experience, the more centered and focused I am in terms of appreciating the simple, ordinary, daily things that are part of my life, whether it's savoring the food I'm now having at this meal, you know, the breathing stuff that Brian and Catherine led us through, or whether it's appreciating the clothes that I have on, not you know, that I always have to wear the same thing or whatever, but just really appreciating that I like what I have on, or whatever it is, the more I can really appreciate and be present to what's happening, the less I need to consume, the less I need to go faster, have more, eat more, wear more, and so on. I think there's a real connectedness, you know, as you indicate, between that and a simpler lifestyle, because then I have enough. Now, that's a very radical statement in our society. You know, the key, the watchword is, I mean, look for it everywhere, is more. To have enough is a very radical action.
Well, a lot of people have more because they aren't satisfied with what
it doesn't
they have because
feel
they won't appreciate mm-hmm.
it. Doesn't
therefore,
satisfy.
It's the bye.
Yeah.
To fill a hole.
Exactly.
Because they have not filled that hole.
Right.
Otherwise.
Yeah.
And if you have, then you don't have that need to be materialistic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, I mean, I try for that value in my life, but I really appreciate Holden because I think it helps me do a bit more of that, slow me down in some ways and really appreciate some things that I have.
I was thinking about the idea of the holy and the ordinary, and one of the things that I got very strongly when I was growing up is, and I'm sure that all of us were touched by this in some way, is that somehow we're not good enough. In order to be loved by God, we have to be something, somehow other, different than the way we are. Mm-hmm. We have to be somebody else, or we have to be in some other way. And I think one of the most profound ideas for me about the holy and the ordinary is the ordinary in us. Mm-hmm. That who we are, just as we are, very, very simple, very ordinary, very confused, whatever it is that we might be, that ordinary is also holy. And I think the truth is that we can only encounter God in this moment, and that means we have to be who we are mm-hmm. in order to encounter God. Mm-hmm. And if we put it off in order to be better or in order to be different, then what we're doing is we're putting off encountering God.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so true. One way that I like to put that is that God loves us and calls us to love one another and the things around us as is, not if only. God's love isn't conditional. If only you will get your act together, if only you will, you know, lose this many pounds or do all these things in your life or whatever it is. God doesn't do that. God's love is an as-is love, and that's the kind of love that we're called to share with others around us and the world around us, and it has an amazing power to it when we do that. But I think you're right, Pam, that that's not the way we were often raised. It was a sense of, you know, if you'll do these good things and be this good person, God will love you more.
There's a new book that's just come out that I just read about this, which is one of the reasons I've been thinking about this, and it just came out this year by a guy named Robert Wicks, and it's called Touching the Holy, and the subtitle is Ordinariness, Friendship, and Self-Esteem. And it's a wonderful book.
Say it again.
Touching the Holy by Robert, I think it's Robert J. Wicks.
W-I-C-K-S.
Right. Ordinariness, friendship, and self-esteem. And so it's not only the ordinariness in us, but it's also in our relationships. Mm-hmm. It's really beautiful. Mm-hmm. Touching the Holy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's another one that I like a lot. A Tree Full of Angels is the title.
Yeah.
Macrina Wiedeker, you know?
Yeah, and it's a wonderful book.
Yeah, it's The Holiness in Ordinary Life. Now, there's a lot of these books. I haven't really referred to a lot of them specifically that are here that talk about a lot of these things, and I'll just mention a couple of them. I don't think this one's in the bookstore. This is called Being Home, and when you were talking about the laundry, I was thinking about it. This is a book of meditations. Her name is Gunilla Norris, and there are lovely photographs with it, and she has things about dusting and planning the day and opening the window and climbing the stairs and looking in the mirror, making the bed, walking, and put, it has a whole meditation on each of those kinds of things. And also another one that I really like is Pray Always, not always, but always, and this has chapters on praying with the eyes, the prayer of tears, how to pray with our feet, play is prayer, suffering, the school of prayer, hurrying, a hindrance to the holy, and so on. And he's very, I think, down to earth and ordinary. One of the my favorite chapters in here is the prayer of napping. I'm not a slow down napping person, and I actually took a nap a couple days ago. And what he talks about is when we nap, we sort of hang out this invisible sign that says, what does he say? person asleep, God at work, because what happens is we can let God take over and run the world for a while we check out. That's a pretty radical action. Caution, person asleep, God at work. Yeah. Anyway, that's a real favorite of mine, and that is in the bookstore. Edward Hayes is his name. Edward Hayes is a real interesting priest who's run a house of prayer in Easton, Kansas, which I have no idea where it is, for a number of years, and he's written a lot of different books, but that's my favorite of his. But
I was reading a very interesting article. I can't remember where or what, but the thrust of it was that in Genesis it says, in the evening, how does that go? In the evening and the first day?
The evening and the morning, the first day.
Yeah. And the thesis was that evening is the beginning of the day. Mm-hmm. And so evening is when God is doing his thing in your mind. So when you go to bed, you say, well, you know, God, we're starting a new day. Mm-hmm. And give me a few instructions, mm-hmm. whether I remember them or not. Mm-hmm. But that was so neat, mm-hmm. to think of, mm-hmm. of God talking to us while we're sleeping. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I find for myself that as simple an idea as this is, for me it takes a lot of remembering and reminding myself, and that's why I have a lot of books on it, I guess, because I need to keep going back to those same ideas, because it's so easy to get caught up in the busyness and the rushing by, and hard to keep remembering that. What I'd like to ask you to do with some of the rest of the time here. We could do it as a large group, but I had envisioned to do it as pairs, so I'll kind of turn that over to you to decide. I'd like to ask you to share about some people, places, or things, or writings that have meant a lot to you and have helped you see God at work in your life. Again, my method here is, you know those things already, but sometimes I find that it helps for me to think about them and to name them out loud to someone else, to really help me see, gosh, there are some real ways in which those are God especially at work. Because I think, you know, all of us live in the same world, but, you know, some of us maybe caught particularly by the flowers we have here in the middle of the room, or somebody else may see, you know, the mountaintop this morning, and that may really be a sign of God. And so when we can help each other key into what, you know, we've listened to and heard in our lives, those that has a value for the other person as clues, but also for me to say aloud how God is at work in my life. Would you like to do that as a large group or in pairs? Okay, that's fine. Sure. Would you? Sometimes it helps. I found, especially as a large group, some of us are more extrovert, and it's right on the tip of our tongues. We can say it, and some of us not. Would you like to jot down some ideas for a moment, and then we can share about that? That might help us all kind of give it some thought first. Let me repeat my question: what are some people, places, or things, or writings that have helped, that have meant a lot to me and helped me see God at work in my life? That's pretty broad. What have been some clues, some pointers for you to help this awareness that we've been talking about? Another way to say it is, what are my burning bushes? I don't know if you know the poem by Elizabeth Barrett Browning, I'll probably murder it, about, do you know that one, Pam? Mm-mm. Oh, it's beautiful. Only those with, I was going to bring it with me and forgot it, with an awareness of God, take off their shoes before the burning bush. I'm really murdering it. But anyway, the rest of us sit unawares and pluck back blackberries. I'm not doing it justice, but it's a great poem. I wish I had it with me. Anyway, what are your burning bushes? Jot it down for a minute, and then we'll talk about it. Any burning bushes for them?
I probably murder this poem too, but it goes, maybe a lot of you can help me. God is not promised, the sky is always blue, flowers from pathways all our life through. He has not promised peace without pain, joy without sorrow. Something without pain.
Joy without something.
Joy without sorrow. Peace. Anyway. But he has promised strength for the day, rest for the labors. Rest for the weary. And the very last ones are unfailing sympathy, unfailing love. That's been on my bulletin board for many years.
That's neat. Yeah.
I get a lot of sustenance from a particular walk I take just about every day that is, in my mind, just a... If I don't take that walk, I feel like I've not really had my time of prayer. And because I can look at the beauty around me, trees, and I think in terms of that I'm a creature of the earth, but I look at the water down below and how we need water, how we need the air, how God is all around me. I find that refreshing.
So it's not particularly, Jan, a time for you to process the day that you've just had or whatever?
No, it's a time to try and
kind of soak
and just clear my mind and focus on where I am and what the leaf looks like, what those trees are like, and how the air is, and smell the air.
Really
be in the here and now. I always feel so sorry for those people who go by with Walkmans on, and I think, you can't hear the birds.
I found that Catherine Marshall's writings brought more to me than, and she may have been the first writer that I really hit that brought so much to that where I can see God working much easier.
It's nice with writers like that that you connect with so closely that you can kind of go back to those regularly when you need to. I know The Gift from the Sea has been one of those for me.
No, but she just, you know, she gives you ideas, and if you put them in your life, and it works, you know. And you're saying, oh, there it is.
Margaret Jensen's books also. First We Have Coffee, and Papa's Place, and Lena.
Oh, Papa's Place. Oh,
yeah. And Lena.
And Conan Mama.
Margaret Jensen. And we have met her, and she is just as exciting as being something as she was a few other books. Fantastic.
There's a place I just remembered when you were talking. My very favorite place in the whole world happens to be on Lake Chelan, down on the lake, about 3 miles down from Stehekin. My aunt and uncle had a piece of property, and when I was a kid, we used to go and summer after summer after summer. They built it by hand. We hauled everything up on their boat, except the main beam came up on the barge, and dug out the hillside, and it was a lot of hard work, but as the years went by, just up from their place, on the way to Stehekin, there's a little place called Windy Point, and that's the place. And you have to climb the hill, and it's kind of a hard climb, but there's this rock that sits out over the lake, and it looks down to Stehekin. Actually, you can't see Stehekin, but you can see all the mountains around it. And what I started doing when I was a kid is I would, at the end of the day, I would, being very tired from working so hard, but I would crawl my way up there and sit on that rock, and it's a very exposed place, and the lakeshore trail goes by there, but hardly anybody stops because people want to hurry back down into the trees. And year after year I would go and I would sit there, and it was very clear to me that God was there. And so what I started to do, I think when I was in high school, is I would leave a rock or I would leave something somewhere that I knew that the snow wouldn't disturb it. And I would leave a memory there, whatever it was that was bothering me at that time or whatever the main issue was. That rock would kind of be a symbol for that, and I would leave it in a certain place, and then the next year I'd come back and it would still be there. And I would pick it up, I'd pick up the rock or whatever it was that I was thinking of, and I'd think about what had happened in the year that had passed. And now I don't get down there as much. And the time will come when I won't be able to climb that hill, I'm sure. But I remember what it looks like, and it's like a touchstone place, mm-hmm. even in my mind, even if my body doesn't get there. Mm-hmm. It's very, very significant as the years pass. Mm-hmm. I'm glad I'm not a teenager anymore. My visits are a little happier when I go there now.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about God in the ordinary, I guess in some ways, taking some of those turning points and trying to keep them alive in your life. Mm-hmm. I went to Central America about 5 years ago, and one of the most important things in my life was meeting people who are modern-day martyrs. Mm-hmm. Met Martin Barrow, who was one of the 5 priests that was killed. And the fire of those people really gave me confidence in faith and in Christ's faithfulness. Mm-hmm. So to try to keep alive that sense, I mm-hmm. think we've gotten in touch, important burning bush for us is local community that serves the homeless in Duluth, and the people that operate that community are on a daily basis acting out in their lives in a way that's a more pure form than what we're able to do in our lives. And so by keeping in touch with them, it's like their dailiness, it reinforces some of our dailiness. They're living closer to the pure sacrifice than we are able to. And by linking with them, it I think it makes you aware of it. None of us are able to do exactly what we maybe want to do, because they aren't living Christ's life perfectly either. But it's sort of helpful to travel the journey with some other people who you see as saints that are doing things that maybe you want to be challenged by.
Mm-hmm. And I appreciate what you said there at the end, especially because I guess I want to challenge you slightly at one point when you say this business of they're living it more purely. Let me go a little bit different direction for a minute here. Bible trivia. Where in the New Testament does Jesus really, to use a very contemporary phrase, I don't know how else to say it, where does Jesus really say, okay, this is the bottom line as far as who makes it and who doesn't into the kingdom?
Yeah.
Where is that passage? Nobody?
The sheep from the goats.
Right, sheep from the goats. Where is that?
I don't know.
Matthew chapter 25, remember, in the king at the end of time will say, and I've been told that the sheep in the Middle, or the goats in the Middle East, excuse me, are quite a bit darker than the sheep, and so it's literally a black and white distinction. There's no grays in there. And what's the determination between who makes it and who doesn't? The final in life, I like to tell my students. What's the criterion on which those sheep and goats are separated one from the other? Do you remember? It's a question of... When did I see you hungry and not feed you? Or when did I see you hungry and feed you now? There are a couple fascinating things about that passage, I find. And I mean, I don't know how many times I read it before this finally jumped out at me. Both those who flunked and those who passed the exam, as it were, said, but Lord, when did I see you hungry and when did I see you thirsty? Not those who served saying, I am now serving Christ and the least of my brothers and sisters, but just doing it, just plain doing it. Now that's really fascinating to me, because it's not Jesus saying, you need to know you're serving me and my brothers and sisters
just you need to do it, and that that's the difference. And so there's that point.